Welcome to the Narratives Library. What happens if a mystery illness wipes out your family and your known world? If you're only 15, can you survive? Mark Smith is also a youth worker who believes utterly in the resilience and resourcefulness of teenagers, so his hero finds a way to survive.
After that day at the supermarket, the whole town began to fall apart. Locals started ransacking houses looking for food, fuel, and medicine. In the weeks before he died, Dad had been stockpiling stuff from his hardware store in an old garage at the back of a property on a quiet street away from the middle of town. He only knew about it because he used to deliver gas bottles to the holiday house next door, but it meant we had our own supplies. The virus was spreading faster, and Gary was quarantined with no one allowed in or out, but most people were too scared to stick around. They took off into the bush to find their way north, carrying whatever they could in handcarts and pushers. There was hardly any fuel left either. A group of men had taken over the petrol station, guarding it night and day. When the electricity dropped out, they set up hand pumps to bleed the tanks into 44-gallon drums that they traded for food. In the end, I still don't know how many people died and how many left, but pretty soon the town was close to deserted. Mum and I sat up into the night and tried to decide what would be best, to try our luck going north or to stick it out in Angari and hope that things got better. As much as we talked, I reckon we both knew we wouldn't leave. We'd buried Dad in the backyard and neither of us could bring ourselves to leave him. Then Mum got sick. Rowdy and me had come back from setting our traps one afternoon and heard the coughing from inside the house. Mum yelled at me through the window not to come in, to stay outside. I opened the back door slowly and saw her sitting at the kitchen table, and it hit me then how tired she'd been those last few days, going to bed early and getting up later each morning. She looked up at me and held up a hand. "No, Finn, stop," she cried. "You can't come in. Don't come near me." I stood frozen in the doorway. Her hair and clothes were wet with perspiration and her whole body was shaking. "Listen to me, darling. Listen carefully. Go and sleep in the house next to the storage shed with all our supplies. I'll be okay. Don't worry about me. I love you, Finny. You know that, don't you? I love you with all my heart, and there's nothing I want to do more right now than hug you. But you can't come back here, baby. Never. You understand? Never." Now when I think about that day, I struggle to picture her face. It's strange the things that stay with me, standing there and looking at my mum for the last time. I remember the light, the way the sun slanted through the kitchen window and caught the wall. I remember the smell of the rabbit I was holding and the feel of the rough pads on the bottom of its feet. And I remember the way Rowdy hung back from the door like he could sense the disease. I went out to our shed and lay down on an old mattress on the floor. I slept on and off, hugging Rowdy to keep warm. In the morning, the house was quiet, but the back door was open and I could see right through the kitchen and down the hallway. Even though I knew it was dangerous, I walked down to Mum's bedroom. Her bed was empty and the sheets were cold. She was gone. I spent most of that day searching for her. I tried to get Rowdy to track her, but he backed away when I held a shirt of Mum's under his nose. I took my bike and ventured further out onto the tracks that led north. She wouldn't have been able to walk far. By the time the sun had set and the light dropped away, I was up the top of the valley near the fences. I'd stopped crying. I don't think I had any more tears in me. I found myself in my favourite spot on top of the ridge overlooking the whole town. With no lights, no movement, no humans, it was just a shell of a town, really. Maybe not a town at all, just burned out shops and ransacked houses. A few months after I lost Mum, I discovered Ray. I'd been hunting out in the Addiscot Valley about 2 hours east of town. As I was setting traps along a fence line, I looked up to see this old bloke pointing a shotgun at me from about 20 metres away. "Oi," he said, "bugger off." I was so shocked to hear another voice, I just stood there staring at him. "Go on," he said, "I told you to bugger off my land." He jerked the shotgun at the bush behind me. "Sorry," I said, "just trying to catch some food." He lowered the gun and turned his head to the side like he was hard of hearing. "I know you, don't I?" he said. I couldn't place him. His hair was long and wild and grey, and most of his face was hidden behind a beard. "You're Tom Morrison's boy, aren't you? From the hardware." "Yeah." "You always spoke funny," he said, scratching his chin. "I recognise your dog too." "Rowdy." Yeah, well, he said, I'm sorry, son, but I only got enough food for myself. How are you faring? Getting by, mostly rabbits and fish. Your mum and dad? Both gone. How long you been on your own? I shrugged. Maybe 6 months? He was nodding and looking past me into the bush as though I was expecting someone else to be there with me. Seen any wilders about? This was the first time I'd heard about the gangs of men roaming the country to the north. Nope, I said. Many people left in town? None, just Rowdy and me. None. Yep. Shit. Through that first winter, me and Ray traded food every month or so. I'd catch rabbits for him and he'd give me honey from his hives or veggies grown in his garden. It was tempting to move out there and live with him. I reckon he would have liked that, but I had my stores to protect and his farm was too far from the surf. The storm was taking its time to clear. I don't sleep well worrying about how the house will stand up to the wind and rain. The next day when I checked the river mouth in the afternoon, the sets are lining up like corduroy. Dad used to say that, meant they were one after the other. So I grab my board and paddle out again, duck diving under the sets as they crash over the bar. They're bigger today and I need to be careful not to drift too far inside the peak. But I've only had a couple of waves when I hear Rowdy going apeshit. When I look back to the beach, I can hardly believe what I see. He's got someone bailed up, leaping up and down and barking at them, then dropping to the ground like he's ready to go at them. I'm whistling for him to back off, but the waves are making too much noise for him to hear me. There's nothing for it, I end up thinking. I'll have to head in. I undo my leg rope in the shallows and hold the board in front of me in case I need protection, but this bloke's just standing there, putting his hand out, trying to soothe Rowdy. When I get closer, I see he's as small as me, thin as a whippet, rangy. Hair long and ropey right down his back and falling across his face. He's wearing an old pair of shorts and a way too big jumper. Then he starts talking and it hits me. It's a girl. Voice real high and panicky. You gotta help me, she says. Wilders, they're coming, they're tracking me.
You've been listening to Mark Smith reading from his novel, The Road to Winter. Narratives is produced by Karina Wynne-Moylan of Arts Canvas Bay FM 99.9 and is supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.